Look, I think the Eastern European rise has just tapped into a moment in fashion which is incredibly feminine, incredibly pretty. It's very ladylike. And a lot of the stuff that they're doing just kind of seamlessly filters into this trend, and it's just a beautiful marriage of cultural background and fashion moment.
Glenys Traill-Nash, fashion editor at the Sun Herald, is in no doubt the hottest emerging names in the Australian fashion industry are frequently those from a migrant heritage. Is this a rebuttal of the sand and surf heritage of Australia? Let's explore the hot new design trends, the ones that are coming from the migrant suburbs that are setting the world alight. Are you finding, or have you found, you know, being a long-term voyeur and writer and critic of this industry, have you found that there has been a lot more injection of cross-cultural materials and fashion over the years, or does it come in waves depending on particular fashion?
I think it could come in waves. I mean, one thing I've noticed lately is the Eastern European movement that we have in Australia. It's astounding. Some of our best designers seem to be from this Eastern European area, like Tony Matuszewski, who is one of our finest designers of the young crowd, and he's getting so much amazing press and is about to show in New York, which is very exciting. So he, you know, he's Macedonian. We've got Mira Vukovic from Mad Cortez, who is Croatian, I believe, and she's doing astounding things, and she's really cementing a place for herself in the industry. And there's another one, a very new one, I think it's only her second collection. The label's called Nevenka. Her name is Rosemary and her surname escapes me, I'm afraid. She is also Croatian. And I think some of the things that I've noticed about these guys is there's, particularly with Nevenka, I suppose, there's definitely a very sort of folkloric element, also a bit with Mad Cortez. And I've spoken to Mira about this in the past, that she really does draw on her Croatian heritage, and she does a lot of sort of beautiful smock tops and things, but then really pushes the boundaries even further, and just beautiful detailing. And they all three, you know, Tony and Mira and Rosemary, they really source incredible fabrics. And there's just always something, I can't put my finger on what it actually is that separates them, but they're all going to be really great. Well, two of them already are really great designers. Rosemary's still just, you know, getting out there, but she's already shown that she's got some beautiful pieces. But there's a certain femininity about all of their designs that is obviously very now, because there's a real return to femininity in fashion. And so maybe that's why suddenly, because they have this history of this folklore, I don't know, I can't...
It's like a mysticism.
Yeah, there is almost, and a whimsy. I wish I could be more articulate about what it is, but it's this incredible, almost like with Tony stuff, almost otherworldly beauty about it. And because, yeah, there's this rise of femininity at the moment, it has just found its moment, perhaps.
When they're sourcing fabrics, are they sourcing fabrics from those Eastern European countries too, and that, you know, the heavy seamstressness of it all? And
I don't know. I think certainly Rosemary, when I spoke to her, she was saying that the last collection which she did, which was her first, she had some fabric which was almost like a tablecloth, and so it was that really kind of almost heavy embroidered cottons and things like that. So I got the impression from her that she does source some fabrics from over there.
Do designers from ethnic backgrounds, is there much history in, you know, sort of ethnic fabrics and designs and cuts and stuff which doesn't suit the Australian climate coming here to Australia and actually being adopted here and successful here?
There are definite cases. I mean, I guess the most obvious one is Akira Isagawa, who's an institution in Australian fashion now. And the interesting thing about him, I think, is with a lot of Asian design, well, there's a lot of Asian influence in Australian design that you see in smaller labels, perhaps, and like using the kind of kimono fabrics and that kind of thing. He's managed to completely break away from that while still retaining an incredible kind of Japanese purity about his design. But there's again with him this kind of whimsical side of things, that and beautiful intricate detailing and handiwork, handcrafting and everything, that has given him, and I couldn't even say his style is Australian. It's just, it's Akira's, you know what I mean? But it does seem to fuse Eastern and Western style beautifully and seamlessly almost.
What I didn't do was exactly taking traditional costumes, national costumes, into my own collection, because a lot of people have done that. And well, yes, I know a lot of designers take inspiration from their own backgrounds and integrate it with their own work that way. But I try to approach it differently. So it's, to me, it's more about the Javanese way of thinking and way of living. That's more important.
Grace Argung is in her final year of her design degree at Melbourne's RMIT. She's one of the 14 students showing her collection at the 2006 Melbourne Fashion Week.
I was born into a Chinese family in Semarang, which is the main city in central Java, Indonesia. We pretty much had an extended family, you know, where how it is in an Asian culture. I was brought up in a more Javanese city, and I think that has affected me very much, even more so, you know, in your way of thinking and how you see the world and how you expect people to behave towards you and how you behave towards them. The city where I grew up, it's not one that specifically targets, you know, oh, you're Chinese or you're Javanese, etc. We mingle so much, I didn't even realize. I went to high school in Sydney for 3 years, and then I came down to Melbourne for my university. My town, well, actually, I should say my city, isn't a very big city. It's not a metropolis. And Sydney was, so there was that shift there.
When you first started drawing, designing, imagining what sort of clothes you want to design, what linkages between the fabrics and the styles that you saw home in central Java and how you could apply them? Did you think, how can I apply these in Sydney?
Actually, the first real collection that I made was a beachwear collection. And that was actually inspired by Bali and the nuances that you get from the sea and the sky. And for that specific one, it wasn't too much the textiles, but it's the little ornaments that you put on the fabrics. So I had little seashells connected to the fabric.
When you first started showing, you know, at university, going through the years at university, did you find that things like seashells and the inspirations from Central Java started to come out a lot more?
Actually, no. For the first 3 years, it didn't really influence me. My works were very neutral, very westernized. It was only this year that I sort of come back to it, because I actually had the privilege of going home for a while earlier this year. So I actually started my working for my collection over there. And just the shift between the two regions were very, you know, severe, at least to me. And you just couldn't help but notice. And what I did was to actually, rather than taking textiles or anything, or colours even, from there, what I did was I started observing the people around, and, well, most of them are not so privileged, they're more poor than anything. So it's just observing their daily activities and the way they interact with each other. That was what inspired me, which was, actually, I shouldn't be, you know, taken aback, because I was born into that kind of culture and I should have been used to it. But just being away for so long and coming back to it, you notice it a lot more. What I did with this, as I said, was look at the gestures. One of the few things about Javanese people, it's they curtsy a lot with each other. You can tell from the way they talk to you, well, the way they talk to each other and their body language. which is what I took. So a lot of bowing movements for me. That was very crucial because it signals warmth and affection that even they show to strangers. I took those gestures and turned them into clothes.
It was interesting, we just had a show, a ready-to-wear show, where there were three Indian designers. And really, the interesting thing about that was that they're clearly not designing for an Australian market. It was very clearly Indian, traditional sort of Indian design, Nehru collar jackets and these long split side coats over those loose pants and
yeah.
A lot of embellishment and embroidery and stuff. But girls here don't really wear that. So that was quite interesting to see. So I don't think they were marketing for us, even though they're obviously wanting to make sales over here, which is a great thing.
But of course, the fashion world rides on people's names, literally, in some respects.
Akira Isagawa, the very name sounds exotic and wonderful, and Tony Matuszewski, I mean, they're beautiful names that trip off the tongue and people go, oh, that sounds interesting, I wonder what they do, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. Well, even if it's literally, like, how do you spell that? You know, because you have to take note of it in a way, because it is different. But obviously people call their labels various things, you know.
That's right. Someone has a name like that, they wouldn't go and call their design house Button or Orange
or Lemon. No, he just dropped the Tony, he's just Matuszewski, which is almost even more awe-inspiring in a way. You know, similarly with Akira, he's just Akira. It's enough.
If someone wants to set themselves outside or above the Janes and Bills and Bobs of the world, does that work well in the fashion industry?
I think absolutely it works quite well, yeah. It does set them apart and give them that sort of otherness that they might be looking for.